to understand who the people on the other side of the table are, how they think, and what they care about. Who are the decision makers? And are these folks purely about maximizing short-run profits? Now, in some cases, they may very well be. As I said, they may be in a situation where Wall Street is pressing hard on them and demanding that they meet certain quarterly earnings targets. But in other cases, many other factors may be shaping their decisions. And so this is crucial. Now, let's think about this in the context of Netflix and Blockbuster. Netflix entered the market in 1999, confronting the incumbent Blockbuster. Now, Blockbuster had a choice. How hard do we fight this new player, or do we accommodate? How did that play out in the movie rental business? Well, one important factor, one important decision that the incumbent Blockbuster confronted early on was, do we cut our late fees? Recall that Netflix came in the market with a different pricing model. They weren't charging per movie. They were charging a monthly subscription. You paid a certain fixed amount per month and rented as many movies as you wanted. Within that, you didn't have to return each movie in a prescribed period of time. You could keep the movie for more days than Blockbuster typically allowed their customer to keep the movie. But of course, you couldn't rent new movies unless you eventually returned the movies you had. So there's some limit there that Netflix imposed. But there were not traditional late fees. Now, Blockbuster had to decide, do we cut late fees, which we know some customers really dislike, to compete with this upstart Netflix? And Netflix is thinking, what do we anticipate about what Blockbuster will do? Will they come after us hard? Now, it's interesting to look at the economic motives of Blockbuster. And I'm sure Netflix did, based on my conversations with people in the industry. Blockbuster was generating at least $300 million per year in late fees in the early 2000s. In some years, that was more than the total operating profit of the entire company. They were dependent on late fee revenue for their profitability. Now, what about Netflix? Who were they in the beginning? Well, in those first few years, they only had a few hundred thousand subscribers. Blockbuster had millions of customers. So do the math. If you're Blockbuster and you cut late fees, you destroy the entire profitability of the firm. But what do you gain? You save a tiny slice of market share. So what do? Blockbuster chose to accommodate. They said, we'll keep late fees in place. We'll cede a few hundred thousand customers to Netflix. But we are, in our interest, we're looking and saying, preserve our profitability today rather than try to save a bit of market share and sacrifice so much of our profitability. Of course, you might say that was very short-sighted. What about the long run? What if Netflix starts to grow and grow rapidly? Blockbuster's estimation, their projection was that Netflix would not grow that rapidly, that it was a niche player, catering to a certain subset of customers, but it would never go mainstream. So with that expectation, they weren't willing to eliminate late fees to save this tiny slice of the market. They were wrong, of course. Eventually, they had to cut late fees, but it took them years to come to that decision. And they only did it when the financials began to turn, when the number of customers that Netflix had built up and accumulated became so large that now the accommodation strategy was costing Blockbuster a great deal of money as well. And now they finally cut late fees. Let's take a look at another example of this dynamic between an entrant and an incumbent, one that played out a little differently. The question was, how will British Airways and Aer Lingus react when Ryanair entered the European airline industry? Would they launch a price war to crush this upstart Irish airline in the late 1980s? And if you're Ryanair, you're thinking and saying, well, if British Airways cuts price, they will take a huge hit to profits, because every dollar that they cut their price, that automatically is one less dollar of profit. And they have a large market share. They have hundreds of thousands of customers. So cutting price significantly will cost them a fortune. And at this point, it was really interesting to see, because British Airways was charging 166 Irish pounds for the London-Dublin ticket. Ryanair was coming in saying they were going to charge 98 Irish pounds. So a price war would mean a substantial drop in revenue and profitability for the incumbent players. Now, remember that Ryanair was only looking at taking a tiny slice of the market. In fact, they originally only had a few planes, and they were only planning on running 4 round trips per day between London and Dublin. And the planes were rather small, so they weren't going to hold a ton of passengers either. So if you're British Airways and Aer Lingus, you're looking and saying, do we destroy our profitability by cutting price so dramatically on this route, or do we give a few seats over to Ryanair and maintain our pricing? Well, but you have to think about the entrant's intentions. Will Ryanair grow? Will they buy or lease more planes? Will they add capacity? And if they do so, then what effect will this have? Moreover, you have to ask, if we play nice with Ryanair today, will new players come in the industry and start attacking us? What precedent will we set by playing nice? Maybe we have to sacrifice profit now and attack aggressively, not only to keep Ryanair from growing, but to keep others out of the market. It's a complicated dynamic. What are some of the principles that we can learn by looking at this situation? I think one of the key principles, for incumbents at least, is you don't want to ruin your whole market just to save a tiny slice. But what if you could target your attack? What if you could identify and focus on the customers most likely to defect to this new entrant? Well, if you could cut price or market aggressively to them, but keep price higher for other customers who are less price sensitive, then you could attack without destroying your profitability. This kind of targeted fight is something that many incumbent firms will try to achieve if they can. And we certainly know in airlines, whenever you get on a plane, you often find the person sitting next to you has not paid the same price for a ticket. So they are trying to, you know, split hairs. They're trying to identify which customers are more price sensitive and how can we adjust price for them to keep them and keep price higher for others to maintain our profitability. But there's a few other principles here that we can learn about competitors and how they respond to one another. For the incumbent, one key is what signal am I sending to other potential entrants by my behavior today? So not what is the short-term impact on my profit, but what is the long-term impact on the competitive dynamic? If I play nice or if I fight, perhaps if I fight aggressively, I will deter other entrepreneurs from coming into my segment. And finally, you have to think about how fast the entrant may wish to grow. What are their aspirations? Is this a company set out on taking over the world? Are they truly a niche player that's only going to focus on a small target customer segment? Understanding that will dictate how you respond. If you think about what you're trying to do as an incumbent player in these markets, what you'd love to do is be able to take action up front to deter entry before the player even comes in. Could you fight a little preemptively and therefore avoid the situation of having to take a huge hit to profits later on to fight them in reality? Could you engage in preemptive action? Let me give you an example of that. Several years ago, Clorox and Procter & Gamble were in an interesting competitive situation. Procter & Gamble, maker of laundry detergents like Tide, was thinking about entering the bleach category. This was one area in the laundry detergent aisle that they did not compete in. Clorox was the dominant player. Most Americans use the word Clorox and bleach interchangeably. The brand was the product. Now, Procter & Gamble was planning on test marketing this product in Portland, Maine, their new bleach. Why Portland, Maine? It was far from Clorox's headquarters in California. It was a small market, and they were all set with a couponing and sampling strategy for introducing their product and testing it out. Now, Clorox caught wind of this. They said to themselves, how might we deter entry by P&G? They launched a preemptive attack. They dropped a gallon of bleach on every doorstep for every household in Portland, Maine. What did Procter & Gamble do? They said to themselves, well, our whole sampling and couponing strategy won't do much good now that everyone has an extra bottle of bleach already on hand. Moreover, we just learned that Clorox is going to fight to the death in this market. This won't be an easy battle. So what did Procter & Gamble do? They never entered the market. They decided to forsake the bleach category. A preemptive strike that deterred entry. A very effective business strategy. So assessing the competitor's response, as a potential entrant, you're thinking about a range of factors that might suggest aggressive moves coming from the incumbent that could be harmful to you as an entrepreneur. Is this a slow growth market? Is this a situation where the incumbent is starving for new customers, where there is no growth, and therefore they might fight to preserve the customers they already have? Is this a commodity product? Is it not really very differentiated? And therefore, it's going to be really hard for the incumbent to argue their product is better, higher quality, etc. And so might they resort to price as their only competitive weapon? Does the competitor have high fixed costs relative to marginal costs? Are they looking to cover those fixed costs, and might they fight hard simply to keep their capacity utilization high to cover those fixed costs? Do they have deep pockets? What kind of resources do the incumbent player have available to it? And therefore, with those resources, might they be able to attack us aggressively? And what about their history? What have they done when other entrepreneurs have come after them or other companies have entered their market? What does their history say about what they might do today? Understanding each of these factors is crucial if we want to be able to understand whether or not we might be in for a really tough fight when we enter their market. And lastly, can they target their fight? Do they have to cut price across the board to come after us? Or can they identify only a segment of customers most likely to defect to us and respond only for those customers to retain them? The more they can target the fight, the more likely they're going to come after us and do it in a way that's really cost effective for the incumbent player. So let's take a look at one final example of an interesting competitive battle. So in the 1980s, NutraSweet was the dominant player in the aspartame or artificial sweetener market. And their biggest customers were Coke and Pepsi. In fact, Coke and Pepsi accounted for almost half of their sales worldwide. Now, their patents were about to expire, and so people were looking at entering the market. Holland Sweetener was one of those firms thinking about coming in to compete with NutraSweet. It's really interesting to see how that unfolded. Would NutraSweet retaliate aggressively? How might they respond? Well, Holland Sweetener made a single big mistake in their efforts to enter this market, and that was they didn't fully understand how powerful the cost advantage that the incumbent player had on them. What do I mean by that? It turns out in the aspartame market, we had huge economies of scale and a substantial learning curve. Therefore, NutraSweet had a huge cost advantage over this new player, Holland Sweetener. The learning curve was so powerful that the cost of producing aspartame had been falling significantly for years as NutraSweet gained more and more experience producing this good. And there were huge economies of scale. You only needed a few factories to produce enough aspartame to serve the entire worldwide market. Now, if you know this, if you understand the incumbent player has these cost advantages, what does this mean for Holland Sweetener? It means the incumbent can fight and fight aggressively because they can bring price way down and still make money because of their cost advantage over us. And Holland Sweetener made a mistake. They had no other way of differentiating their product. It was the same basic product. With no cost advantage and no differentiation, they were toast. Moreover, they made one other mistake. They didn't apply a little game theory to understand NutraSweet's behavior with respect to Coke and Pepsi. Holland Sweetener was counting on Coke and Pepsi to shift some of their volume over. They figured Coke and Pepsi don't want to be so dependent on NutraSweet. They'll want to shift some of their volume, especially if we offer them an attractive price. But Coke and Pepsi were caught in a prisoner's dilemma, explained by NYU professor Adam Brandenburger. He said Coke and Pepsi were caught in a situation where it would have been in their interest to switch some volume and get a better price from Holland Sweetener, but neither wanted to move first. Each looked and said, if we move, will our opponent attack us? Will Pepsi say to Coke, you're changing an ingredient and it's changing the taste of your soda? Maybe that's not true, but would they try to argue that to the customer and vice versa? And so NutraSweet was able to retain those customers neither wanted to switch. A story of not fully understanding your competitor and getting caught in a really difficult situation, and Holland Sweetener never made money in the artificial sweetener market. There's value, you know, in role-playing the competition. That's an important lesson that we can learn from sports. What do great football coaches do? Right? They study the film. They look closely at their opponent, and then they have a scout team. What's a scout team? That's a set of backup players that practice and behave as if they are the opponent. They pretend to be the rival before the big game. And that helps the first team players, the best players, try to understand what they're going to do when they actually get into the game. There's a great story of this in the 2004 AFC Championship game in the National Football League. The New England Patriots were playing the Indianapolis Colts, Tom Brady against Peyton Manning. And my beloved Patriots won that game and went on to a Super Bowl victory. After the game, Bill Belichick spoke at a press conference. If you've ever seen one of these press conferences, you know they're rather odd events. Belichick doesn't exactly like talking to the media. But here he crowed about a particular player. He boasted and bragged about the incredible effort of Damon Heward. Damon Heward? Who was he? A backup quarterback who had never stepped foot on the field that day. Why was he being praised by the head coach? It turns out that Heward had pretended to be Peyton Manning, the opponent, all week during practice. He had copied his mannerisms, copied his throwing motions, copied everything that he thought Manning might do in the game. What did that enable the Patriot defense to do? It enabled them to practice against this perfect copy of Peyton Manning and to get better as a result. What's the point here? Role-playing the competition can be very powerful. Asking people on your management team, can you put yourself in the rival's shoes and can you role-play how that competitor might respond? Pretend to be them. Will it be helpful? Every management team should have its scout team. You'd have some people who are pretending to be the management team of the competition and helping them practice for the real deal in the marketplace. Now, sometimes this competitive dynamic between an incumbent or an entrant or between two existing players can actually not be so vicious, can be rather cooperative. How come sometimes two rival firms end up cooperating with one another and not competing aggressively with one another? When does that happen? Well, cooperative behavior is more likely to emerge when there are only a few competitors and when they've known each other for a long, long period of time. If there are many players in the market, then it's hard to maintain cooperative behavior. There's a greater likelihood that one player will cheat, that they will start cutting price, that they will start doing things aggressively and undermine this sort of tacit agreement to play nice with one another. You say, are there really markets where people play nice with one another? Well, take a look at Coke and Pepsi over the years. They competed hard in terms of their advertising, their marketing, yet they never engaged in price wars with one another. In a sense, it was a friendly war. They grew the overall market together, and they both enjoyed strong profits. But there were only two of them, and they'd known each other for 100 years. Contrast that with other businesses, like the fitness center business, where there are many, many competitors, where the market's really fragmented, and where the competition is intense. So what are some of the lessons from this lecture? Think ahead and anticipate. Think about your economic and non-economic motives of your competition. Consider the people. Who are they and how do they think? Balance the short run and the long run. Think about the hit to profits today, but also the long run implications of your actions and your competitors' actions. And try to put yourself in the rival's shoes. Try to role play the competition to get better at what you do. So your assignment for lecture 7. What should you do now to reflect on what we've learned? I want you to suppose you're going to open a new restaurant in the town in which you live. Who are the incumbent players? How are they likely to react to your entry into the market? What are their economic motives? And what about their non-economic motives? How have they reacted to past entries by other players? And how should you adapt your strategy given your expectations about how those restaurants will react when you open yours?
This lecture is titled, Why Did Disney Buy Pixar?
Think about the Walt Disney Company for a moment. Consider the businesses in which they've chosen to compete. Just a few of them. Theme parks, a film studio, cable television channels, hotels, retail stores, and consumer products, just to name a few. Why is Disney choosing to compete in all of these businesses? That is a fundamental question about corporate strategy, our topic for this lecture and subsequent lectures. Here with Disney, we're talking about a multi-business unit corporation. We're talking about a company with a corporate office overseeing multiple subsidiaries. And each of these subsidiaries or business units is competing in a different product market. The question when we look at a firm like this is, why is the company choosing to compete in a wider range of businesses? Why are they choosing to compete in multiple product markets? And are these businesses somehow better off because they're together? The fundamental question then of corporate strategy is the whole worth more than the sum of the parts? For Disney, their hope is that the answer is yes, that somehow 1 + 1 = 3, that the theme parks are somehow more valuable as part of the Disney family than they would be as an independent company, that the cable television channels, likewise, are more valuable as part of the Disney family than if they were outside the portfolio, that somehow these businesses are stronger, have a more formidable competitive advantage because they're working in unison. We often hear the term synergy when we talk about that cooperation among multiple business units within a corporation. Synergy, the idea that 1 + 1 = 3. Walt Disney captured this beautifully with a quote once. He said, "I only hope that we never lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a mouse." The mouse, the characters, in fact, are what tie a lot of the units at Disney together. Many of them leverage the power of the characters. Think for a moment about the theme parks. Are we attracted to the theme parks just because there's great rides there, or do the characters add additional value to the theme park experience, making the theme parks better competitors against theme parks that do not have those famous Disney characters? There's two levels of strategy then that we're covering in this course. Up till now, we've been talking about business unit strategy. We've been talking about how a company chooses to compete. How do they try to gain advantage over their rivals in a particular product market? But now with corporate strategy, we're not looking at how to compete. We're asking the question, where do you compete? As a multi-business unit corporation, why are you choosing to build this particular portfolio of businesses? Why is Disney choosing to compete in the movie product market, as well as the theme park product market, as well as the cable television product market? Not how do they achieve advantage in any one of those markets, but why are they choosing to compete in that entire set of businesses? That's the question that we want to ask in this lecture, as well as in several moving forward. Now, there are several types of corporate strategy that we will evaluate. Two basic types: horizontal integration and vertical integration. And with each, there are two types within them. So let's start with horizontal integration. That's the idea that a company is choosing to compete in multiple product markets, hopefully achieving some integration or synergy across those businesses. There are two kinds of horizontal integration. There's what we call related diversification and unrelated diversification. Related diversification is when the company appears to be competing in related product markets, products that have something to do with one another, where there are apparent synergistic possibilities. Unrelated diversification is when a company appears to be competing in markets that don't have much to do with one another. Do such firms exist? They do. Think about General Electric, the Virgin Group, or in the past, a company like Sara Lee, which competed in a wide range of businesses in products that didn't really have much to do with one another. General Electric, for example, making everything from airplane engines to plastics to light bulbs to appliances to running a television network for many years, NBC. As for related diversification, examples of that include not only Disney, but a company like Procter & Gamble, which has a wide array of health and beauty aids, as well as laundry detergents and other items that it sells in its portfolio of products. So horizontal integration can involve either related diversification or unrelated diversification. But then we also have a second type of corporate strategy, and that's what we call vertical integration. Now it's not about competing in multiple product markets, but it's taking one particular product market and deciding to compete along multiple pieces of the supply chain. Think about this in terms of two types: forward integration and backward. Backward integration is when a company chooses to produce its own components or raw materials. Forward integration is when a company is choosing to own its own distribution or retail store network. So think about Apple choosing to open its own stores. That's an example of forward integration. As for Amazon, think about when Amazon's decided to become its own book publisher. It's not just selling books, but publishing them. That's backward integration. Backward integration is when we're moving back toward the earth and toward raw materials. Forward integration, when we're moving closer to the end user. So corporate strategy involves these two fundamental broad choices. Do we integrate horizontally? Do we compete in multiple product markets? And do we integrate vertically? Do we choose to operate at multiple points along the supply chain? Now, how can we evaluate a corporate strategy? We can ask two fundamental questions about each of the businesses that are part of this family, this portfolio. The first is each business better off as part of this corporation than it would be by itself? And the second question we can ask is, does each business unit within this corporation outperform comparable focused companies? Companies that only compete in that product market and nowhere else. Do they do better than their rivals? If they do, then presumably they're getting some benefit from being part of this corporate family. It's strengthening their competitive advantage. If not, maybe they should be elsewhere and not part of this portfolio. So related diversification is all about this idea of synergy, or what economists call scope economies. And related diversification is about trying to achieve these scope economies among businesses competing in similar product markets. Put another way, related diversification is when a firm is trying to share resources or capabilities across multiple businesses, whether it's distribution channels, sales forces, or R&D facilities, or factories. In Disney's case, they're sharing the characters across multiple businesses, leveraging them to enhance the value of their television, of their theme parks, of their consumer products, of their stores. To define economies of scope more precisely, what we mean is that either a business unit's willingness to pay is higher because the units within a firm are working together than the willingness to pay would be if these units were independent. And or each business unit's costs are lower because the units are working together than the unit's costs would be if these businesses were independent. So economies of scope exist in a related diversification strategy when each unit either has stronger willingness to pay or lower costs because of their cooperation with their sister units. In other words, a good corporate strategy is all about strengthening the competitive advantage of each of these business units, making them better off than they would be on their own. Think for a moment about the theme parks at Disney. Do they have higher willingness to pay or lower costs as a result of being part of the Disney family? I would argue they do. In particular, I want to focus on willingness to pay. Are we willing to pay more to go to a Disney theme park than to generic theme parks operated by competitors like Six Flags? Many people are. Now, why are they willing to pay more to go to a Disney theme park? Because Disney theme parks are working together with other business units in the Disney family, most specifically the animation studio. They're drawing the characters in from the animation studio, building attractions around those characters, bringing the characters themselves into the theme park and having them sign autographs, take photos, eat meals with young children and families. All of this raises the willingness to pay and makes the theme parks a tremendous competitor against more generic rivals. Economies of scope exist. Now let's think for a moment about Disney's capabilities. Disney represents a powerful example of a company that leveraged a set of resources and capabilities into a number of different businesses, leveraging those characters. And when we think about the characters at Disney, we should point out that these resources are quite valuable because they're highly durable and hard to imitate. Others can't imitate the Disney characters because Disney has protected that intellectual property. They've patented and copyrighted them. But moreover, the characters are really durable. They last forever. Unlike a factory asset, a piece of machinery that depreciates, it seems as though the Disney characters, they appreciate in value over time. Moreover, every few years, a new generation of children is born, and their families introduce them to those characters. And Disney can appropriate the value associated with these resources. In other words, when they create something based on those characters, they can garner much of the profit. As Warren Buffett once said, the mouse has no agent, right? We don't have to pay Tom Cruise a big share of the profit from making a movie. We get to keep the profits. It's a wonderful thing. Now, the question then is, how can you think about leveraging these valuable resources across multiple business units? A strategist needs to think about how specialized versus how fungible or general a resource is. What do I mean by that? A highly fungible resource or capability is something like brand management expertise, innovation, risk management, a fairly generic capability that you can apply widely across a range of businesses. A highly specialized capability might be a patented product formula or specific engineering expertise in a very narrow discipline. Now, why is it important to distinguish between fungible and more generic capabilities from those that are more specialized? Well, a fungible capability is something you can easily transfer across lines of business. But if it's too general, it's not unique enough, you won't be able to get substantial competitive advantage based on having that resource or capability. On the other hand, highly specialized capabilities can convey powerful competitive advantage, but you may not be able to transfer them as widely. They're narrower in their applicability. And this is really important. In other words, there are only so many areas in which you can grow based on a highly specialized set of capabilities. What does this have to do with Disney? Well, think about it. In the 1980s, Michael Eisner arrived at Disney, and the company was in tough shape. It needed a turnaround, and he executed a remarkable turnaround at the time. Disney's core capabilities that he built and enhanced revolved around animated character development and deployment. In other words, Disney's capabilities were highly specialized, and they were able to leverage those capabilities to enter new businesses, like the hotel business and the retail store business. But ultimately, growth was constrained by the very specialized nature of that capability. There's only so many things you can do with animated characters. You don't want to hurt their value in any way by branching out too far. But Michael Eisner wanted to grow the company, and he had an aggressive growth plan. How can you do that? He wanted to move into more diverse businesses in order to achieve his revenue targets. Now, Disney has to be able to make the case under Eisner that it has capabilities that are more fungible, that can be stretched to many more markets. And so Eisner began to talk not just about animated character development. He began to talk about the fact that Disney was excellent at managing creativity. He defined Disney's capabilities more broadly. He didn't want to talk about the specialized capability of animated character development. He wanted to talk about creativity management. It enabled him to justify the move into a broader range of businesses to achieve his growth goals. Well, there's some challenges associated with defining your capabilities very broadly. It's more difficult to make the case that you're truly unique and superior to all your rivals in that set of capabilities. Is Disney really better at managing creativity than all the other firms that it competes with? It also becomes rather difficult to discriminate among various options for diversification. In other words, how many businesses have something to do with managing creativity? You could argue many, many different kinds of businesses do, and begin to articulate a justification to move into things that are pretty far from what you're really good at, from your core. On the other hand, if you manage and you think about your business in terms of developing and deploying family-friendly animated characters, it narrows the kinds of businesses that you're likely to enter. So now think about it. What happened at Disney during Eisner's tenure? He spent about 2 decades at the firm. In his first decade, he soared. The company did incredibly well. He was focused around leveraging the characters. As he stretched his definition of what Disney was good at and began to move further and further away from that core business and started to argue that scope economies existed between what they were doing and some things that looked really different, like owning a hockey team and a baseball team or the Miramax film studio that made adult films like Pulp Fiction, and doing a wide range of other things, performance started to suffer. And in the second half of Eisner's tenure, the stock lagged the general market, the stock market overall. Now think about the recent moves by Bob Iger, the chief executive who took over from Eisner. He's had great success financially, both in terms of profit and stock performance. What's he done strategically? I would point out, interestingly, that Iger appears to have returned to the formula of leveraging characters. He's made 3 big acquisitions during his tenure. He bought Pixar, which owned characters like those from Toy Story and Finding Nemo and The Incredibles and Cars. He bought Marvel, and most recently he bought Lucasfilm, owner of the Star Wars and Indiana Jones franchises. What do all of those acquisitions have in common? He's back to defining Disney as being in the business of leveraging a specialized capability, character development and deployment across a range of businesses. Now, just looking at this issue of synergy alone is not enough in thinking about whether multiple businesses should be under one roof. We also have to ask ourselves, maybe there's synergy between two businesses, but do we have to have them under one roof, or could we operate as partners? Two independent firms cooperating with one another, achieving some synergistic value, but maybe we don't have to actually merge our two companies. And you know, there's some cost to having to bring two companies together under one roof, added bureaucracy, costs of going through a merger. Maybe we could stay independent, cooperate, and achieve economies of scope without having to go through and bring us totally together. Let's think about that question for a moment. Let's think about it back in terms of Disney, in terms of two businesses that they have, a hotel business and a consumer products business. Why did they initially choose to own many of the hotels near their theme parks? On the other hand, they're in the consumer product business, but they don't make their own toys and games. They outsource the production of that. So toys and games are synergistic with the rest of the Disney family, but they've chosen not to actually do all of it in-house. They've outsourced. What's different about the hotel business versus consumer products? Well, initially it might strike you that the hotel business is much more of an experience, right? We've got families going to breakfast with the characters. The characters walking around and signing autographs and taking pictures with these families and these children. It's a really interactive experience. Consumer products, outsourcing the production of that, we can draw a clear diagram, a design of what we want, and we can ask a manufacturer in Asia to make it for us at a low cost. Two very different businesses. So what's the key question we have to ask ourselves if we want to analyze the decision to keep hotels in-house versus outsource the production of certain consumer goods at Disney? We have to go back to a Nobel Prize winner, Ronald Coase, and a famous paper he wrote in 1937 called The Nature of the Firm. He asked a crucial question. Why do firms exist? Seems like a rather odd question. Why do companies exist? Well, he said, if markets are such a great way to coordinate economic activity, why is not all activity conducted through the marketplace with small firms run by entrepreneurs? Why do we need large organizations? And he refined his question. He said, should economic activity be coordinated by the market mechanism or by intra-firm organizational structures and processes? In other words, should I contract with an outside supplier to make components, or should I build and run my own factory? And how do I decide whether to use a contract through the market or to organize component manufacturing within my own firm, in my own factory? His answer, you have to look at the transaction costs associated with organizing certain economic activities. Many years later, Oliver Williamson extended Coase's argument. He, too, was rewarded for his great work. And between Coase and Williamson, they've given us great insights to help us understand corporate strategy. To help us understand transaction costs, suppose I'm considering signing a contract with an outside supplier for components for a personal computer. There are costs, time, money, effort, risk, associated with conducting transactions with outside parties. Contracting with them may be cumbersome and difficult at times, and there's a risk that one party may renege on the contract or not fulfill its obligations. On the other hand, there are also transaction costs associated with coordinating that activity within my firm. I have to get my personal computer assembly plant to coordinate with my component manufacturing operation, and they may not exist in the same geographic location. The question then becomes, under which arrangement will the transaction costs be lower? What's more efficient, doing it in-house or outside? To give you an example of this, consider Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts. You note the two have made a very different choice about their restaurants. Starbucks has chosen to own most of its freestanding stores in the United States. Dunkin' Donuts, on the other hand, has chosen to franchise most of its freestanding stores in the country. So why and how might transaction costs help us understand the contrasting decisions of these two players? Well, think about it. Starbucks is trying to create an experience within their store. Howard Schultz, its founder, talked about the third place. There's home, there's work. And then there's a place where we can gather, do work, talk to friends. It's Starbucks. It's an experience. We're not just selling coffee. Dunkin', much more about selling coffee, much more of an easy transaction. Get in there, get out very quickly. So if you were going to contract with an outside party, where is it easier? Is it easier to do at Dunkin' or at Starbucks? The answer is pretty simple. It's much easier to contract with a franchisee at Dunkin'. It's much harder to write into a contract at Starbucks how you would want a franchisee to operate that experience. So you keep it in-house, right? It's too difficult to use the market. And this is something that we see also with hotels at Disney. It's rather difficult to tell Goofy how Goofy should behave at breakfast with my child, right? So you keep Goofy in-house. You run the hotel yourself, and you train that employee on how to interact with children. And you monitor closely how that interaction takes place every day. On the other hand, consumer products produced in Asia, you can outsource that. You can monitor from afar, and you can use the marketplace to get the best price for producing that good for you. So we make this choice. What drives transaction costs? Well, three big things. Uncertainty. The more uncertainty in the market, the harder it is to use contracts to work with an outside party. The more likely you may move activity in-house. Frequency. The more frequently we have to interact with one another, maybe we might as well just bring our companies together as opposed to having to constantly work through the marketplace. And lastly, there's the issue of what we call asset specificity. Market coordination becomes very difficult and costly when the potential arises for what we call opportunistic behavior. Such potential exists when economic actors invest heavily in what we call transaction-specific assets. In other words, when factors of production are really specific to the other party. Let me see if I can explain. Imagine an oil refinery, and it only has one way to pump its oil out to its customers, and that's a pipeline attached to the refinery. The pipeline has only one use, to pump the oil from that particular refinery. What will happen in that case? Could they be independent companies, and could they simply contract with one another? The answer is no. Each asset is totally specific to its partner asset, and therefore, they're totally dependent on one another. What's the problem with being highly dependent on another party? Well, now the opportunity for opportunistic behavior arises. One could renege on the contract, put the other in a precarious position. One could say, I want to reopen the contract. I'd like a better price from you. Their codependence makes it difficult for them to operate peacefully through the marketplace. Contracting is difficult, so we see them come together in the same firm. So this choice then, this choice is between do it in the market or do it outside of the market, do it within the company. Well, no, it's not quite that. It's really a spectrum. The choice is never simply contracts versus firms. There's a whole spectrum of choices you make with regard to corporate strategy. On the one hand, you could contract with an outside party through the marketplace. On the other hand, you could have two entities, an oil refinery and a pipeline, come together. But there's a whole bunch of choices in between. Joint ventures, strategic alliances, franchising, licensing. A whole spectrum of choices. So, you may have two companies that have an ability to cooperate, to achieve synergy. The question is, do they do it as independent companies? Or do they have to come together more closely through an alliance, through a joint venture, or maybe they have to merge? So think about this in the context of Disney in its acquisition of Pixar. Think about asset specificity and codependence. And consider the correlation to pipelines and refineries. Disney initially worked with Pixar back when Steve Jobs was CEO of a young outfit called Pixar. Steve Jobs had bought Pixar from George Lucas. And they were looking at making their first feature film, which turned out to be Toy Story. Now think about it. You're not Steve Jobs, the legend you are today. You're Steve Jobs, the unemployed former CEO and founder of Apple. You've bought this little outfit called Pixar that no one's ever heard of, and you think you're going to make a movie when you've never been in the movie business. Who's going to distribute that movie? Nobody. It's going to be really difficult to distribute that movie. You need help. So you go to Disney. You go to Michael Eisner. You say, will you help market and distribute this movie? And so they evolved. They came to some agreement. They formed a contract, a partnership. They didn't merge at that time. But Disney was in the driver's seat, and they extracted some significant concessions from Steve Jobs and Pixar. They said, if the contract ends, and when it ends, we get to retain the characters that we worked on together and continue to use them in sequels and within our theme parks, even if you, Pixar, eventually move on to work with another movie studio. Well, that was very powerful. Eisner was in the driver's seat. Steve Jobs needed Disney, much more than Disney needed Pixar at that time. But now what happened a decade later? A decade later, Pixar had had remarkable success. Every one of its movies had gone to number one at the box office. Disney Animation, it was really struggling. It had had some real tough times, some hard years. It had not had repeated successes like Pixar. So here was Jobs threatening to go elsewhere. He wanted to negotiate with Universal or others, or at least he was threatening to do so. Why did he not go to somewhere else? He didn't really get along with Eisner. Why didn't Pixar go elsewhere? Why did they end up selling to Disney? Well, you could argue that these two firms had evolved into a codependency that made it difficult to work together through a contractual relationship. But the codependency made it so that they really needed to come together. They couldn't go their separate ways. Why were they codependent? Well, at this point, Disney really needed Pixar in a way they didn't a decade earlier. Because Disney Animation had fallen on hard times, they needed a fresh infusion of characters to fuel synergy in the theme parks and on cable television and elsewhere. But wait, did Pixar need Disney? Could Pixar really walk away? Remember the contract concessions originally negotiated by Eisner and Jobs. As John Lasseter, the creative head of Pixar, said, "Over my dead body will I see Toy Story 3.5 straight to DVD issued by Disney, and we're not part of that. I can't give up my beloved characters." The two companies were codependent on one another, much like the oil refinery and the pipeline. And therefore, they couldn't work together through the market. They had to go deeper and come together in a merger and achieve that synergy. And now the Pixar characters are leveraged, much like the Disney characters, across that range of businesses. Pixar was more valuable as part of the Disney family because Disney could fully exploit the value of those characters in a way few other firms could do. So what are the lessons for us from this lecture? Multi-business unit corporations competing in a wider range of product markets must be able to articulate that the whole is worth more than the sum of the parts, that each business is more valuable, has a stronger competitive advantage because it's part of the family than if it were on its own. Related diversification, then, is all about the logic of economies of scope, the idea that you have higher willingness to pay or lower costs because you're working together with sister companies. Now, cooperative behavior to produce these mutual benefits, does it all have to happen inside the firm? Perhaps not. Maybe sometimes we can outsource part of what we do and work through the market through a contract with an outside party and produce mutual benefits. But sometimes that contracting is cumbersome, and sometimes there's the opportunity for opportunistic behavior. And in an extreme case, so much codependency that we need to actually bring it inside the firm and work together as sister companies within one portfolio. Of course, sometimes there are diseconomies of scope, something we haven't talked about yet, but I'll leave you with. Could it be possible that we get into multiple businesses and now trying to manage multiple businesses actually causes us more harm than good? Can it be so difficult to manage different businesses that we actually destroy value rather than create it? And this is something we're going to talk about in an upcoming lecture. It's a real challenge, and I would simply argue now that executives sometimes overestimate economies of scope. They overestimate synergy to justify their move into new businesses, to support their growth ambitions, and it can get them in trouble. So now to close, what's your assignment? Select a diversified firm, such as Procter & Gamble, owner of a wide variety of brands such as Tide, Ivory, Neutrogena, and Swiffer, or Darden Restaurants, owner of multiple restaurant chains like Olive Garden and Longhorn Steakhouse, and ask yourself, what synergies exist among the business units within these companies? Is the whole worth more than the sum of the parts? And maybe even look and say, how and why have they changed their portfolio of businesses in recent years? Perhaps maybe executives have reconsidered the extent of the synergies among these units within their company.
This lecture is titled The Diversification Discount.
Consider for a moment two historical corporations that used to be very successful, Fortune Brands and Sara Lee. Fortune Brands was a large diversified firm that competed in three segments. They had a large golf business that used to be quite successful. They had a liquor business that sold distilled spirits. And they had a division that sold home hardware products. Then consider Sara Lee. Sara Lee did far more historically than produce baked goods. They operated the Piggly Wiggly chain of supermarkets. They had Coach handbags, Jimmy Dean meats, Playtex and Hanes undergarments, Chock Full of Nuts coffee, and the Hillshire Farm brand of meats. What do these two firms have in common, and how are they different than Disney? Disney is a related diversified firm, trying to pursue synergies or economies of scope across related product markets. Fortune Brands and Sara Lee are two classic examples of unrelated diversification. They're competing in a wide range of product markets where there are no apparent economies of scope or synergies. Why then have these firms assembled the portfolios that they did? Was there an economic logic to bringing together unrelated subsidiaries in one corporation? Well, interestingly, these corporations have both broken up. That is to say, today, the conclusion has been that the whole is not worth the sum of the parts, and these companies gradually sold off divisions and became much narrower in their focus. We'll try to understand why that happened. Why did management come to that conclusion, perhaps at the behest of investors, over time? There's some interesting evidence that has accumulated over the years with regard to diversification, particularly unrelated diversification in the United States. And I stress the United States because later in the lecture I'll talk about some key differences between developed nations and emerging markets with regard to the strategy of unrelated diversification. Numerous academic studies have found that diversified firms trade at a discount to their breakup values on average. Now, what does that mean? What do we mean by breakup value? Well, what analysts and investors are doing all the time with regard to diversified firms is they're examining what the firm is worth today. What is its market value? And they're comparing that to something they call the breakup value. What does that mean? Well, let's say a firm has three major divisions. They take a look at a hypothetical scenario. What if this firm broke up? What if the three divisions were independent operating companies? What would each of them be worth independently? And if we add up those three, the sum of the parts, is that worth more or less than the whole is worth today? A diversification discount is when the whole is worth less than the proposed sum of the parts. And unfortunately, for many diversified firms, particularly unrelated diversifiers in the U.S., the whole seems to be worth less than the sum of the parts. And it's why we've seen many corporate breakups in the last few years. Not only have Sara Lee and Fortune Brands broken up, but in 2014, we saw some very successful corporations like HP, Hewlett-Packard, or eBay, or the Gannett Corporation, parent company of USA Today, all engage in breakups, each of them splitting in two, Gannett separating its newspaper and publishing business, and broadcasting business. Then we saw eBay splitting off PayPal and HP breaking into two corporations. In each case, analysts looked at it, management analyzed it, and concluded the whole was worth less than the sum of the parts. Research from academics has also demonstrated that focused firms, firms that focus on one product market, tend to do very, very well in the United States. Studies have also shown that increases in focus tend to be followed by stock price increases. And decreases in focus, efforts to diversify, often are followed by stock price decreases. Furthermore, research shows that spin-offs, when a company splits off one division and sets it out as an independent company in the market, those spin-offs tend to outperform the overall stock market after separation from the parent company. In addition, the remaining parent company tends to outperform the market after the spin-off. This evidence has been accumulated over several decades in the U.S. and has proven to be a powerful rationale for companies slimming down and for less and less companies to pursue a strategy of unrelated diversification. Now, we have to offer a few words of caution, though, before we draw wide-ranging conclusions from that academic research. Research does show that, on average, diversified firms trade at a discount. But about one-third of diversified firms trade at a premium to the breakup value. Most of those are related diversifiers, like Disney. There are some other issues with this research about the diversification discount. Some research suggests that firms that choose to diversify may be trading at a discount prior to diversifying. In other words, they're struggling, their core business isn't doing well, and therefore they go diversify, sometimes into unrelated markets. So the poor performance actually comes first before the diversification. Furthermore, the businesses that are acquired in diversifying acquisitions, they themselves sometimes tend to be poor performers. So companies buy a poor performer in hopes of driving improvements in the business. What this means is that we have to be really careful. When we analyze a particular company, we know the research. We know in general we should be skeptical in the U.S. of unrelated diversification. But we have to look at each company in its own right and understand its strategy. And here's where things get a little fuzzy. Are companies related or unrelated diversifiers? Sometimes it's a little hard to tell. Management may be arguing that in fact the firm is pursuing a related diversification strategy, that synergies exist. Investors and analysts may be skeptical. They may look and say, no, we don't think this is actually a related strategy. It looks unrelated to us. We don't see powerful economies of scope. And therein lies the key question. Who's right, the investors or management? And you'll often see a back and forth going on this. In 2014, DuPont was facing this question. Investors and analysts were arguing that different parts of DuPont actually were not as related as management tended to believe. And those analysts wanted to see a breakup of DuPont. On the other hand, executives at the company were arguing that it was a related diversification strategy. Now, there are several invalid reasons for diversification, reasons that are sometimes used, well, often in the past were sometimes used, as justification for unrelated diversification. And these are invalid, and there are four of them. First, we're diversifying risk. We're going to have some businesses in the portfolio that tend to do well in a strong economy, and other divisions that are countercyclical. And therefore, when one is doing very well, it could offset others that aren't doing as well. And this is a less risky strategy, having different divisions that can balance each other out. This is invalid as a reason for diversification in the United States today. There's a second invalid reason for diversification, and this is what we call cross-subsidization. This is when we have a portfolio of seemingly unrelated businesses at different stages of the business life cycle. And what we're doing is taking the cash that's being generated by profitable but mature businesses and using it to fund growth in newer high-growth industries. We could see this in a company called Allied Domecq several years ago. They were a European distilled spirits and wine company. They also tended to own some other companies that were cash cows, if you will. For example, they owned Dunkin' Donuts. What were they doing with the Dunkin' Donuts brand? Well, they were drawing cash out of that very profitable business and using it to expand further in the wine business. So they were cross-subsidizing from one unit to the other, though those units were really unrelated. No synergies at all between donuts and wine. There's a third invalid reason that people pursue unrelated diversification, and that's that they sometimes are looking for revenue and profit growth because of problems in the core business. Foster's of Australia did this some years ago. They had a strong beer business, but one that had matured. There was no growth in the business. So they looked for other opportunities, wine in particular, where they might find new growth. But in fact, we learned that beer and wine, well, they're not as related as you think. See, we have to be careful when we define related. We don't mean just that the products themselves may be consumed together. We mean that there are truly powerful economies of scope between the businesses. And in Foster's case, they learned that beer and wine, well, there aren't such powerful synergies. So just looking for growth is not a valid reason to diversify. And finally, we see sometimes where companies are trying to manipulate the stock markets. They're trying to take a business that maybe is very mature and not growing and enhance its valuation in the eyes of investors by acquiring a newer, higher growth business. The Washington Post did this some years ago with the ownership of Kaplan Educational Business. Kaplan was growing rapidly, and they were trying to use that to create a higher valuation in the market, though the newspaper business was lagging behind. All invalid reasons for diversification. Now, what do we know about diversification of risk? Right? Why is it not valid when a company says we're pursuing this strategy because we want to make sure that we diversify risk? After all, we all know as individuals, it makes good sense to diversify our investment portfolio. We don't want all our eggs in one basket. Well, the key is this. You as an individual can diversify on your own much more effectively than the firm can do and much more inexpensively. Why? Well, you can simply buy mutual funds or index funds and quickly diversify your investment portfolio. You don't need an extensive corporate office and bureaucracy at a large corporation to buy and sell whole businesses and amass a portfolio to achieve diversification. You can do it on your own. Now, what's the premise here? The premise is that markets are relatively efficient. Now, this doesn't mean we have to believe markets are perfectly efficient. That doesn't mean we believe that every stock is perfectly and appropriately valued by investors. It simply means we believe the external capital market does a much better job of moving resources around and valuing opportunities than the so-called internal market. That is, that a manager at the top of the corporation is not as smart as the crowd, as the entire external market. And this is really important, and we have some evidence to back up that individuals are not as smart as the crowd. What evidence is that? Well, we know, for example, that the typical portfolio manager at a mutual fund does not beat the market. On average, most mutual fund managers do not beat the market. That says that external capital markets are reasonably efficient. And therefore, if that's true, you as an individual investor, you can diversify on your own. You don't need a corporation like Sara Lee to diversify for you by buying and selling unrelated businesses. Now, what about cross-subsidization? Why is that invalid? Well, cross-subsidization, taking money from mature businesses and funding new opportunities, this came from a concept introduced by the Boston Consulting Group many years ago, the so-called BCG matrix. They argued that an unrelated business, an unrelated corporation, could effectively classify its units in different ways. And they looked at two basic measures by which you could classify your businesses. One is, what kind of market share do you have, high or low, in a particular business? And how fast is that particular industry growing? So suppose you have a unit that's in a slow-moving industry, and you have low market share. They called that a dog. But if you're in a slow-moving industry and you have high market share, they called that a cash cow, a business that was generating a lot of cash and didn't have a lot of new investment opportunities in which to plow that cash back in. It was generating excess cash. What about high-growth industries? Well, if you have low share in a high-growth industry, they called that a question mark. A possible cool opportunity that could really turn out to be very profitable, but we don't know yet. We're in a high growth industry, but we haven't yet established a prominent position. And finally, there are the stars. High growth industry, high share, an excellent performer. What was the logic of this matrix? Well, the idea was to divest the dogs and milk the cash cows and take that excess cash from those slow moving industries and plow it back in and invest in the question marks and help them grow, even if they were unrelated. Now, what's wrong with this concept? Again, it presumes that managers inside the firm can allocate resources better than the external market, that they're smarter and that they know where the best new opportunity is and they can beat the market. Very difficult to do. It even assumes that they know when and how new growth opportunities will emerge. It's difficult to figure that out. What do we know? Well, we know individual investors have often said, wait, if there's excess cash in a business, why not give that back to the investor and let them go out and find the next new opportunity? Ask yourself this question. For these question marks, these promising new opportunities, where should they get their capital? Who's going to be better at funding them? Venture capitalists, angel investors, private equity firms, or the leaders of a large, bureaucratic, complex, mature corporation? Most today believe in the United States that we'd rather see those question marks depend directly on people who every day are looking at startups and figuring out which ones are promising and which ones aren't. You know, Robert Kennedy was the chairman of Union Carbide, and he reflected on this BCG matrix some years ago in a book by Bennett Stewart. And he said, that when corporate management gets into the business of allocating resources between businesses crying for cash, it makes mistakes. The investment community, he says, is a better sorter-outer. Bennett Stewart's work confirmed Kennedy's observation. It found that financial restructurings that severed the link between mature cash cows and promising growth opportunities increased market values. Bottom line, question marks should depend on the market for their capital, not on a large corporation cross-subsidizing from an unrelated business that happens to be a cash cow to a new opportunity. So both cross-subsidization and the diversification of risk are invalid reasons for unrelated diversification. Well, then what might be a valid reason? Here we have to distinguish between something we call economies of scope that we discussed with regard to Disney in a related diversification strategy and something we call governance economies. Governance economies potentially can be a valid reason for unrelated diversification. What are governance economies? Well, unrelated diversification is when a corporate parent is not trying to add value to each of its businesses through the realization of synergies. Instead, the parent is operating each business fairly independently, and they're trying to realize this notion of governance economies, which is the idea of trying to add value by employing a common management system across all the units. You're trying to use common management processes and best practices to drive performance. You're disciplining each management, overseeing and controlling the operations, transferring knowledge and best practice among them. You're managing the businesses better than they could be managed on their own. That's the premise here of governance economies. In short, the unrelated diversifier believes that these businesses are better off being managed by the corporate parent than independently. It's purely management skill that they're trying to leverage across their businesses, not tangible resources and capabilities such as common distribution channels, common production facilities, common research and development. Well, what's an example of a firm that's pursued governance economies perhaps successfully over the years? Most would point to General Electric as the classic example. Throughout the 20th century, GE was a high-performing stock, outperforming the stock market over that 100-year period.